This is a production of Cornell University.
I am Jay Robert Lennon from the Creative Writing Program, and I will be introducing Shauna Seelye to you in just a moment. But first, I have a few announcements, suggestions, handy tips, etc. First of all, I want to thank you all for coming. We work really hard on this series, especially Laurel and Marianne, who do all the heavy lifting. And it really makes it worthwhile to see so many people come to these readings. The response to this series since we started it has been tremendous, and the crowds have been great. So thank you very much for coming. I also want to thank our anonymous donors, two Cornell alums without whom the series would not be happening, and also Elena Viramontes, our director of creative writing. I also want to acknowledge John Niederbuhl from the college store, who's going to be selling Shauna's book right here, as he has done with books of all of our readers since time immemorial. And should you want Shauna to sign your book, which you will, you can have her do that up in the lounge after the reading, because we're having a reception in the lounge on the second floor, to which you are all invited as soon as we're done. I want to also remind you of our podcast, which is at writers@cornell.blogspot.com. I tried to interview every writer who comes, and I just put up the interview with Shauna this afternoon, and it's on the site. Also, I did an interview with Irakli, those of you who saw his reading last week and are interested in hearing more about him and from him, that's available for a quick download on the site. Also, we're gonna do about a 10-minute Q&A after the reading, so if you have something you want to ask Shauna, I'll be standing here making sure that no improper questions get through, and she will rove around through the crowd, talk show host style, shaking your hand. No, she'll answer your questions from right here. So I met Shauna in 1991 when we were both entering our senior year at Penn, where we went to school together. I had subletted for the summer a room in a house that had been rented by some friends of Shauna's, and I came down from my room one day to find her sitting with one of the renters, a guy named Russ, in the living room. And I thought she was pretty cute, so I figured I ought to suss out the relationship situation. So when Russ left the room, I was like, so how long have you guys been going out? And and it was the expression of delighted horror on Shauna's face that convinced me that we were gonna be friends. It wasn't that there's anything wrong with Russ. On the contrary, he was a nice guy. Although he's the only grown man I ever met who claimed never once in his life to have masturbated, which is a little strange. Yesterday when we were musing about what Russ has been doing for the past couple of years, the obvious answer was he probably masturbated. But no, Russ wasn't the reason she got this expression, I think. It was that I had stumbled upon one of the great obsessions of Shauna's life, that situation so beloved of novelists, the embarrassing personal encounter. As our friendship developed, each of us grew to be the one the other would call whenever we made a fool of ourselves, uttered some random idiocy to a professor, or frightened off some potential romantic conquest, or attracted the attentions of, as always seemed to be happening to one or the other of us, some random crazy person on the street. And we also got to be writing buddies. And we confessed to one another our shared ambition to be novelists. In fact, just yesterday, when Shauna was giving a talk to the MFA students, she told a different version of our meeting story, in which, there in the living room of the rental house, I was asked what I planned to do over the summer, and I replied, write a novel. This revealed me to be the insufferable prick and self-absorbed liar I obviously was at the time. But it also served as our first exchange about the endeavor that was soon to consume our adult lives. Both of us worked diligently over the next decade trying to develop a voice, I suppose. And Shauna found her voice, even as she maintained the detailed meticulousness with which her writing had come to be characterized. She figured out how to marry memory to landscape in her own inimitable way and began to write the stories and fragments of stories that would find their way into her novel. When she told me yesterday that the process of writing, when we get there, was haphazard and mystifying, shot through with frustrations and reconfigurations of tearing down and building back up, you would never in a million years know this reading the novel. It's a perfect gem of a novel. It's strange and humane and darkly comic. and it's written in a tight prose style that vibrates with restrained energy. Like Shauna herself, the book is finely made and generous and lovely, and you will think it is awesome. And it's right there. Just think, it's right there. So while emailing back and forth to Shauna a few weeks ago, I told her that I wished we could send a message back in time to our 20-year-old selves and let them know that a day would come when we'd actually manage to become writers, and that I would have the pleasure of introducing her to this crowd on this campus on this day. But really, I think those younger versions of us would probably have told the messenger to go to hell and return to our lives of ecstatic humiliations and vague hopes. Those are the kind of lives, after all, that got us here, and maybe in some obscure way we actually knew what we were doing. In any event, it would be a crime to keep this wonderful writer from you for another second. So please welcome my friend, Shauna Seelye.
That was really nice. Thank you. And thank you so much all for being here. The last time I was at Cornell, I remembered I came here as like an 18-year-old kid to interview at the hotel school, and I didn't get in. So, but now I'm staying in the hotel school's hotel. So, you know, that's something. That means something. Yeah, so that story that John told about meeting him for the first time, he really did say, this summer I'm going to write a novel. And I just thought, oh my God, I can't believe that kid said that. Like, I kept saying it all night to my friend. Can you believe he said that? Can you believe he said he's going to write a novel, you know? But that was just because I wanted to write a novel, but I never would say to anybody that I was going to write a novel. And I actually wasn't doing any of the work to write a novel. I just had this idea in my head that I was going to write a novel somehow. But then John was always worked really hard. And you probably did, like, write a novel that summer. I don't know. No, don't you write one every summer? Okay. So the other thing that's kind of funny, the last time I read in an auditorium, I used to teach at St. Albans School in DC, and they let the kids from parts of the lower school came to the reading, and this little seventh grader got up after it was all over, and he very earnest, he was the first person to ask a question, and he said, the first thing he said, okay, so how do you get an agent? I thought that was pretty funny. But anyway, one thing I had started to tell a story, and I assume that there are people from the writing program here and other people that are interested in writing, and I'd started to tell this story yesterday to the graduate students I met with, and I sort of didn't finish it, so I thought it's sort of related to some of the stuff John was talking about wanting to write and writing. And when I was living in New York, a while after we graduated, and I had this apartment near a bookstore, and I would just sit there thinking, okay, now I'm going to write a novel. And I would, you know, sit at my computer, and I'd think, I'd been reading novels all my life. I mean, as an English major, I always read. And then as soon as you sit down to write one, you think, oh my God, what is a book? Like, what are books made of? Like, it's the whole notion that you know what they are just totally disappeared for me. So I would go down to the Barnes & Noble that was like two blocks from my house, and I would go to the new fiction section, and I would open the books and read all the beginnings. I would just go like row by row, you know, and I read them out loud, and I think, oh, that's a good beginning, or that's a good beginning, or that's what a beginning is, you know. And then I'd go back to my apartment and try to write something, but probably watch television, actually, feeling discouraged. And then I went away and got an MFA, and I left town for like 6 years. And by then, I had actually written a lot of this book that's here, mostly through the process. I wrote a whole bunch of short stories and that were all about the same kind of region. And then I started to put them all together. But anyway, so I moved back to the city, like 6 years after I had been reading all those beginnings, not too far from where that first apartment was, and I'd run into the same, you know, when I'd get frustrated, I'd go down to Barnes & Noble, and this time when I would go to the new fiction section, I would read the ends of all the books. And I would think, okay, now these are what endings are like, you know. And then you know, I'd stayed there and I worked on my book for a while, and I went to a couple different places working on it. Maybe 2 years after that, I returned to New York to read from my book at a bookstore, not that bookstore, but I went back to that Barnes & Noble on purpose, and I went to that new fiction section and I bought my book. So that's a story for all the writers in the audience. Anyway, so just a little bit of background on the book. I'm just going to read from the first chapter, so you won't have to know a lot about it. But, you know, if you picked it up in a store, you would maybe know a little bit about it just from reading the back. Anyway, it's set in a coal mining town in western Pennsylvania, not far from Pittsburgh. There are a lot of these towns around Pittsburgh, and where there'd be like all Russians or all Serbians or all Croatians or all Slovenians, or, you know, different groups of those, you know, people from Eastern Europe working in the coal mines. And my dad grew up in a town like this, and I spent all my life listening to stories about this town. And when I was a kid, we didn't live there, but he made me become a tamburitzin, which is like a does anybody hear tamburitzin? Tamburitzins, reveal yourselves. No. That's like a Croatian traditional musician. Okay, so you wear like a kind of folksy looking dress, and you play these really interesting instruments. So I played a preem. I had to learn how to play this preem, which is like a tiny high-pitched mandolin, you know. So that made me very popular in grade school. I could do that. But anyway, a lot of stuff about that stuff seemed not that cool to me as a kid, but then when I went away to school and I realized that place was really unique, you know, I never went any place like that ever again. And I still haven't. So when I started to write some of the stories that ended up in this book, a lot of them ended up being about this town. And so, I know, I sort of found the thing that I wanted to write about, which was probably really what I should have been doing when I was going to Barnes & Noble all the time, looking at other people's books. But anyway. Okay, so I'm going to read from the beginning, and we'll have to decide if this is a beginning of a book or what it is. Anyway, it starts very fast. I wanted a fast beginning, so pay attention. Oh. I was greasing the cookie sheets, watching my grandmother and her sisters do shots of whiskey and feed each other moonshine cherries, when Zoli came into the house, pressed his hand against my throat, and whispered that he would kill me dead if I didn't tell him where my mother was. My grandmother put her drink down and said, "What in the hell are you doing here?" They both worked at the plate glass, and he had rough hands like she did, covered with cuts. He pressed hard on my Adam's apple. I couldn't swallow. He nodded and said, "Christmas, Slats, just having a conversation with Lucas." The plate glass was closed for the holiday, but he was wearing their deep blue uniform. It was stained and dirty. "A conversation with Lucas," my grandmother said. She got up from the table. "Well, that should be rich. He won't cough up more than two words a day for me." She walked over to the chopping block where she'd been carving the stems out of peppers and picked up a knife. In my ear, Zoli said, "Tell me where she is, you little fairy boy." I was still holding the stick of butter I'd been using on the cookie sheets. I dropped it. Slats walked to the sink, turned on the tap, and ran water over the knife. Her sisters were quiet. They were all in dresses with aprons over them. We were in great-grandfather's kitchen. It was 1974, the year I turned 13, the year my mother disappeared. The knife Slats was cleaning was big with a wooden handle. She shut off the faucet and pointed the business end of the knife at Zoli. Some of her sisters yelled, some of them scattered. She said, "You listen, you crazy son of a bitch, get your hands off of him." He loosened his grip on my neck, but he pulled me closer. "Is Mariana here?" he said. "She sure as shit isn't," Slats said. "Well, where is she?" he said. "California," Slats said. "California?" I asked. Zoli took his hand off my neck and moved it to my shoulder. "Where in California?" he said. Slats said, "What are you going to do, go there? It might as well be Arabia." All of Slats's brothers came into the kitchen then. They were big. They wore flannel shirts, jeans, farming boots with thick brown soles. Zoli picked me up under my armpits and held me in front of him. My feet were off the ground. I heard the metal click of the screen door, and then we were outside. It was still bright daytime. We fell back off the steps and hit the ground. My head knocked on his chest bones. His belt buckle dug into my back. The great uncles were on us then. I tried to get away. Zoli crossed his arms over my chest and held on to me. The great uncles couldn't pry me from him. They kicked him. They got on their knees and landed punches on him. I caught a fist on my arm. Red and black flannel covered my eyes and scratched my face. Great-grandfather's dogs barked and growled. They shoved their noses through, trying to get a piece of us. I shut my eyes against their hot breath, the snap of their teeth. Slats yelled after her brothers to be careful of me. She called for the dogs to come to her. Zoli kicked and squirmed, but he didn't punch back. He turned us over, pressed my face in the cold grass, and said, "I know you know where she is." And then his head cracked against mine. He'd taken a boot. He said, "Mirjana, Mirjana," soft and sad, as if he were praying to her, or to me, or to God. I felt his knee on my shoulder, and everything got lighter. He was off of me, running. Slats's brothers ran after him. He got in his green Skylark with the black top, tore away up the drive, and disappeared in the tunnel of trees. Everyone said my mother looked like Hedy Lamarr. The way Zoli looked at her, you think she was Hedy Lamarr. He liked to say it was against the law to be as beautiful as she was, and then he'd pick up the phone and pretend to call the police or the fire company. Sometimes he did call the police or the fire company. He thought the two of them should get married, but she didn't think so. She told him she'd stay a widow until she stopped dreaming about my father, and that she would probably never stop dreaming about my father. One of the times Zoli proposed, he took her out behind the plate glass and set up a sheet of blue tinted glass between two trees. They watched the sun go down behind it. When she said no, he spread out his arms and walked through it. Slat said he was a gypsy with no sense. My mother said he just didn't understand some things. Love, she told me, didn't have anything to do with walking through a piece of glass. In the kitchen, great-grandfather passed around a bottle of pear brandy to Slats's brothers. He raised his little fist in the air, smiled, and said, "Such unkind boys I have made." He had a visitor with a long black coat. The man took the brandy and passed it to me. Slat said to him, "He only just turned 13, Eli. Maybe next year." "Let's see young Lesar's chest," he said. I should be in like a Russian accent, but I can't really do it unless it's like really hokey. "Let's see young Lesar's chest," he said. I didn't remember seeing him before, though everyone else seemed to know him. I wasn't sure how he knew my last name. He had the same accent as great-grandfather, but not as thick. And while great-grandfather had only two hairs left, he had a full head of it, all snow white. "No one is looking at his chest," Slat said. But they were all staring at me, expecting something. I unbuttoned the top button, the second button. Eli said, "Look, young mister, if you drink this, it will make your hair here." He pointed to his own chest. He said, "Like this," and opened his collar to show me the big white tufts. "And you'll grow very fast, faster than regular boy." Slat said, "I have to cook. Don't destroy him." She turned away from us and went to the stove. I took the bottle. Great-grandfather made the pear brandy himself using fruit from his own tree. In the spring, when the buds came out, he would put bottles on them so that the pears would grow inside the bottles. People in the family thought the pear brandy could heal you. When the animals were hurt, great-grandfather poured it on their wounds. My mother drank it when she felt a cold coming, though she didn't like the taste of it. She'd had me rub it on my gums once or twice for toothaches, but I never swallowed it down whole before. I lifted the bottle and took a long drink. It was sharp and bitter, but I didn't cough or spit. Eli made a big circle with his arms and took a deep bow, as if he'd just done a magic trick, and everyone clapped. When they turned away from me, I touched the skin over my heart. It was still smooth, like the skin on a pebble. Sorry. Has anybody here ever had this pear brandy of which I speak? It comes in a clear bottle, and the pear is actually in the bottle. It's very pretty. It's very, very strong. So when you drink it, just have a little bit. Somebody bought me a bottle for when I was working on the book, and they'd read the part of the opening. So they bought me a bottle for a gift, and I said to myself, "I won't drink this bottle of pear brandy until I finish my book," you know. And then when I was like schlepping around house sitting and looking for free places to live so I could work on my book, I always had this giant bottle of liquor with me, but I would never open it. And then when I did finish my book, I said, "Oh, I'm not going to drink that bottle stuff until I sell my book. And then when I sold my book, I just still didn't want to drink it. I said, okay, I'm going to drink that, because I sort of didn't believe that they were actually going to publish this book and give me money for it and put it in a bookstore. And I said, okay, you know, I'll do it when I see the galley, because then that means they're really going to make my book. So when the galleys came, I still wouldn't drink the... But then finally the book did come out, and my partner made me drink it because she was tired of me carrying it around and talking about it all the time. Anyway, but back to the farm. Meanwhile, back at the farm, my mother had been gone for 2 weeks. She had been staying with me at my house, where we waited, without saying so, for her to come back from wherever she'd gone to. Since great-grandmother had passed on and Slats was the oldest of the daughters, she was the boss of Christmas Eve dinner. So even though I didn't like going to the farm, she made me go up there with her to get ready for it. For days, we'd been boiling things and cutting things and kneading things. After the dinner, everyone would eat and drink and go out to the barn at midnight, because at midnight on our Christmas Eve, the animals could speak. Neighbors called us hard Russians, since we didn't have the Pope, and we took our Christmas on the 6th of January. Great-grandfather's house was big and pale white and on the rim of a cupped valley. The front door and the mailbox faced a long driveway lined with oak trees that led to the county road. But I'd always thought of the kitchen and the dining room as the front of the house, because they were usually crowded with people and because their windows faced the valley. No one ever sat on the front porch or used the front door. They always came up the short stoop of concrete block steps on the side of the house into the kitchen. There was a table in the kitchen with silver legs and a yellow top. At Christmas, we pushed the table against the wall so that people could get in and out of the room easier. But they liked to congregate there, and if Slats didn't chase them away, they'd stay all day talking and drinking. Slats had 4 sisters and 5 brothers. Each of them had 5 or 6 sons and daughters, and some of those sons and daughters had children. Usually at Christmas Eve, I would have run around the property with the other boys looking for animal skeletons, or I would have stayed in the house with them staring at the gun cabinet or trying to get at the liquor. But that year I kept close to Slats, her purple dress with the flowers on it always just in front of me. Slats complained a fair amount about all she had to do, but everyone knew she liked being in charge of the kitchen. Usually she got her hair done once a week, always on the same day at the same time, and it was always the same color, a kind of reddish brown. But she'd gone on a different day to get it done, especially for the party, and she'd been sleeping on a pillow shaped like a horseshoe to keep it looking right. She dressed up too. Most of the time she wore plain skirts or jeans and big shirts with milky mother-of-pearl buttons that used to belong to my grandfather. In the kitchen, she'd stop what she was doing every so often and fix her lipstick in the reflection of the silver-plated fan cover that hung over the stove. A few times in those days leading up to Christmas, I forgot about my mother altogether, and it was just regular life, just shaving a carrot with a blunt knife or pouring honey out of a jar for the katya. Then someone would say, wasn't that Mirjana's recipe or sweater or plate? And I'd come up out of the dream. Close to dinner, Slats made me help her set up card tables in the living room and drag in a picnic table from outside so there would be enough room for everyone. She didn't want people in chairs eating over their knees like gypsies. She set down plates and I followed her with silverware. I said, well, how's she get out there? Out where? Slats said. California, I said. Oh, that, she said. She picked up a plate and polished it with her apron. Then she kept going around the table. When we were through, she grabbed my arm and led me outside. It was getting dark. She pulled me toward the barn, her heels wobbling in the mud and stones. We weren't wearing coats. She let go of me and rubbed her arms to keep warm. We went to a part of the barn I'd never been to, a floor up above the cows and goats and sheep. It was dark up there. The only light came through the places where the wood didn't fit together. I heard her feeling around on the wall for something. Then she opened a hatch, and suddenly we had a view of the whole farm. I could see the pond at the bottom of the slope the barn was on, the hayfield up to the left, and over on the right, the old cornfield, where great-grandfather had an idea once to dig for oil and then to dig for water. It was all pocked with holes and craters and looked like the front of the moon. By itself, between those 2 fields, in a clear patch of meadow he never opened for grazing, was the pear tree. It was winter, so the branches were bare. There were bottles scattered around the bottom for when the buds would come in the spring. The last sunlight of the day shone off them. We stood there for a while looking at everything. Slats said, California is more like something to say when you don't know the answer to a question. It's not so much a real place like this here. When we'd all settled around the dinner table and it was time for great-grandfather to tell his story about coming to America like he did every year and for everyone to toast him with his pear brandy, he didn't do it. He looked around at all of us, his shot glass shaking a little in his hand, and apologized for landing us in a country of disappeared women. He turned and looked only at me, and then he put his glass down and started eating his dinner. We dipped bread in honey to remember that life is sweet, and then we dipped it in garlic to remember that life is bitter. There was katya on the table with honey and crushed poppy seeds to eat for good luck and deep sleep. There was hay under the table so that people would think about Jesus in his manger while they were eating. I didn't think about Jesus, though. I thought about how Zoli used to say he would string me up if my mother kept denying him. I thought about the three miners who got killed by the black damp in the explosion that killed my father. They didn't get cut up or burned. They died from the inside out. When there's a fire or an explosion in a closed-in place like a coal mine, the air isn't any good for breathing. If you're down inside and you hear a big booming noise, you can make a run for it. If you get out with only a little of it in your lungs, you'll probably be okay, though you might come down with some pneumonia. But the mouth of the mine is usually too far away, sometimes a mile, and the black damp gets all through you and chokes you. They found two of the miners in a dinner hole sitting with their pails on their laps, sandwiches still in their hands. The one I thought about the most, though, was the one they found on his knees. He had his hands together in a prayer. I'd always thought my father had it the worst of them, but I was starting to think that the guy who was praying did. That guy knew what was coming, and he knew he couldn't do anything to stop it from coming. After dinner, great-grandfather asked me to walk his friend Eli home. Eli said to him, "No, no, I don't need ambassador." Great-grandfather said, "Lucas will see you two there. It's late, cold, he is company for you." Slats was surrounded by sisters. They were deep in with the dishes. I was nervous about leaving the house, and I must have looked it, because Bensie, the oldest and biggest of the great uncles, said to me, "Don't worry, Lucas, that Zoli won't fuss with you no more. He won't come around here again." Another great uncle said, "Not after that beating." Bensie smiled. Outside, I looked at the parked cars and up the road for the Skylark and was glad for not seeing it. I followed close behind Eli. We walked up the driveway toward the county road. A few of the dogs walked alongside us for a while and then trailed off. Eli walked leaning over as if he had a cane, but he didn't have a cane. His bones poked at his coat. Whenever he said anything to me, he called me Luca, and there was no correcting him. After a long while, he turned off the driveway onto a grazing field, but there wasn't anything around, no houses, no cars. At the end of the field was a set of woods. He stopped, pointed at the wall of trees, and then stepped into them. The ground was thick with bushes and twisted vines, and the trees were packed close together. I couldn't imagine there was any kind of house in there, but after a while of picking our way through, we got on a skinny path that led to a shingle brick shack with one window. He fished a big skeleton key out of his pocket. He opened the door, walked in, switched on the light. I stuck my head in the door. "This where you live?" I asked. "You could say this," he said, "is like living." There was paper every place, pinned up to the wall, spread out over the chairs and tables. There were books on the floor, piled under the furniture and against the walls. I looked at the papers that were tacked up. From what I could tell, they were hand-drawn maps of coal mines. There were so many of them, and they were tacked up so close to each other that you couldn't see the wall behind them. "What are those for?" I asked him. "I was engineer," he said, "in mines." "Which mine?" I asked him. "Mines," I said, "many mines." "You been in King?" I asked him. "Of course. I was been everywhere, through all of Seam. It was my job to understand if we dig here," he put his long fingernail on one of the drawings, "what will happen to over here?" And he moved his hand to a different part of the drawing. "Maybe rocks are falling down, or ceiling, or whole place. Always something wants to come apart." He took off his coat. He had a map of the bituminous fields tacked over the fireplace with the Pittsburgh Seam colored in yellow and red like a gash. He had stacks of papers all over. Some of these were drawings of mine tunnels, some had numbers scratched over them, and there were just regular maps of the county, of Pennsylvania, of other states, West Virginia, Ohio, one of the long stretch of California in light yellow. While he was hanging up his coat, I shoved the California map in my jacket. He turned around and said to me, "If you make so tremendous a hole in the ground, there is big pressure, Luca. He lifted up his arms and pretended to be pushing down hard on something with both hands. Everything will make some movement, you know. Try to make hole go away. The navigators who worked for Christopher Columbus were Croatians from Ragusa. My father liked to tell me about this. All of his people were Croatian. He was born in Banning, but he didn't learn English until he went to first grade. He would say I might think my homework was a heavy chore, but going to school for him was like going to a new country every morning. He told me that navigating was a science, but it was also a kind of sorcery, because it was looking into the future. What was up ahead? Islands with friendly people, storms with waves as big as mountains. Without the Croatian navigators, my father said, there would be no coal mines in America because there would be no America. So it was our own fault we had to work them. Every morning when he was getting ready to go into the mine, my mother would lodge a piece of cotton between my father's pinky toe and the one next to it. This way, if there was an accident, we could know him from his piece of cotton. But the real reason she did it was to make sure nothing would happen in the first place. To her mind, if she spent the morning preparing for a disaster, there wouldn't be a disaster. The fire shot that exploded next to my father was so strong, the pieces of his bones got lodged in the coal wall. They had to mine those parts of him out with picks. My mother never dreamt about him, even when he was alive. That story was just something she cooked up to say to Zoli because it was hard to argue with the widow of an exploded miner when she said something like that. I found the path out of Eli's woods back to the field. I heard something move behind me, a click, and then there was a bright flashlight shining at me, and Zoli's hands were on my collar.